Welcome to Shazam, the podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete. I'm your host, Kayla Drescher. This week's episode, what's happening to restaurant magic after a pandemic? How do you train a horse? There's a lot of information going on, and it begins in 3, 2, 1. Hello, all. At the time of recording this, it is November 4th, which means still nothing has happened with the election, and I still don't know what's going to be happening, so I'm a little bit tired, didn't sleep, very stressed. I'm not going to say too much about it because I don't want to dive into the world of politics necessarily, but I just want to say this is going to be a tough week, and by the time you're listening to this, it's already been a tough week. And all I can say is I hope you have a plan to move forward for both self-care and for country care. I guess that's a term I can use. I'll just make it up. In terms of self-care, I was reading something that said, make sure you have a plan as you move forward. So in terms of self-care, what are you going to do? I'm just trying to educate myself a lot more on things, read a lot more, have some fun hobbies, work on fun magic. Hang out with great friends. And that's been really helpful in the last week. And then country care. What are you going to do to move forward to make sure that your friends and loved ones have basic human rights? That's really all we're looking for. So keep up the good work if you're already on it. If you're not already on it, make sure you get on it because there's lots to be done regardless of what the actual outcome is here. And that's all I wanted to say on that. That's basically been my life, so I have no personal update. I've just been thinking about politics. So we're just going to move on to what is an amazing episode. So we did record this back in July, I believe. So really only about halfway into the pandemic as we are now. So a couple of things have changed. You'll notice them, but for the most part, the information in here is timeless because our guest this week is the amazing Suzanne the Magician. Ah, I'm so excited. Suzanne's the best. Okay, audiences all over the country have been falling in love with Suzanne since 1985. She resides in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and can be seen locally there at Birches on the Lake, Lord Fletcher's, Old Lake Lodge, and Rockwoods. These are all restaurants, if you didn't know that already. Her engaging style makes the audience an essential participant in her performance. Other respected professional magicians have called her flawless and amazing, and I would very much agree with both of those adjectives. She is a favorite at Hollywood's famous Magic Castle and was awarded Close-Up Magician of the Year in 2010 by the Academy of Magical Arts. She still, to date, is the only woman to win that award. She also appeared on the widely popular CW show Penn & Teller's Fool Us, and she fooled them, what? And was the first woman to do so. Her specialty is close-up magic for corporate and private events, and you're going to hear a lot about the theory and work that goes into being just that good. So let's get to it. Please welcome Suzanne!
Hi, Suzanne!
Hi, Kayla!
I'm so excited. Thank you for joining Shazam. You would have just heard an introduction on all of the amazing things Suzanne has done. But Suzanne, I'm going to ask you the really annoying, stupid question, which is how did you get your start in magic?
You know, I think magic sort of fell in my lap. I did not intend to be a magician at all. I was a computer programmer. That's what I went to college for. But when I was a kid, my dad's friend's son, you got all that?
Yes.
Taught me the 21 card trick. But he presented everything he taught me a few things as puzzles. And I liked puzzles, like brain teasers. And that's why I ended up being a magician. And then through certain things that happened in my life, I ended up meeting Al Schneider. And he started teaching me. And then I just ended up being good at it. So I stopped being a computer programmer and started being a magician and So I never really worked towards that goal. It just kind of happened. And
about how old were you when you were like, oh yeah, I'm actually good at this?
Oh, 23. So I didn't even start taking lessons from Al until I was 23. So I knew the 21 card trick, a bunch of bar bet kind of puzzly things, and this little one step ahead, funny one step ahead thing that I ended up changing the presentation for, because that one also was presented like a puzzle. And now I teach that one step ahead thing to like beginner students, or if somebody wants to learn something at a restaurant, maybe I'll teach that to a kid at a restaurant or something. But other than that, I didn't know anything. So Al had this clean slate to work with.
So restaurant magic, you're doing all these restaurants. I mean, and you're still doing, well, not maybe not during a pandemic, but pre-pandemic, you were still, you're at a restaurant 4 or 5 nights a week. Is that right?
I have three different restaurants. Yeah.
So obviously at this point, restaurants are, I would say, they're old hat for you. So if somebody wants to get into restaurants, we understand there's lots of different ways that they could get a restaurant. But once you're in, you have to be good at it. One huge debate that is always going on in magic is the approach to the table. So what's your approach to a table? How do you get people interested in watching you? And how do you not make it feel like you're a burden to somebody's dinner plans? How do you choose the table? How do you approach the table, et cetera?
Excellent questions. I found out that my main purpose at the restaurant is not entertaining people. And it sounds like I'm talking about something else, but I'll get there. My main purpose at the restaurant is to help the restaurant run more smoothly. Because especially on a Friday or a Saturday night, the servers really get in the weeds. It doesn't take much at all for them to get way behind. And once they get behind, they get more behind and more behind and more behind. So having me there to kind of smooth that out and buy them 10 minutes is golden for them. So after I realized that I actually can help the servers, I enlist them to tell me what table would be helpful to them. So that's the first thing that I ask for when I'm looking for my next table, is I go to the servers who truly get my value. Some of the servers kind of don't get my value, and that's okay. There are enough servers who do get my value that sometimes they'll even fight over me, which is great. So I'll go up to those servers and say, where can I help you? And they'll say, go to table 42 or go to table 21 or whatever. So that's one of the ways that I pick my table. And then when I approach that table, I say, hi, my name is Suzanne. I'm the magician here at Lord Fletcher's, and your server sent me over. She said you're her favorite table. She thought you would enjoy a little bit of magic before dinner. And so that does a lot of things. One, it tells them who I am. So I'm not just some rando walking in off the street, gonna try to do some silly card tricks for them. Two, the server sent me over. And if the server sent me over, that most likely means I'm free. Mm. I'm not gonna cost anything. The server is giving them a gift. Even if the server doesn't send me over, I still use this approach because I found that it really works. And you're her favorite table. That's the most important thing right there. They hear me say that. They may believe it, they may not believe it, but they always go, oh, we're the favorite table. And because they're the favorite table, well, of course, they're not going to say no.
Right. They're the fun table.
Right. So they're the fun table. They're the most fun table in the whole place. So I'm official. The server sent me over. They're the favorite table. And I'm probably free. And yeah, sure. Do some magic for us. And I'm coming up confidently. I'm not coming up going, would you like to see a little magic? Could I do my little card trick for you? And if they say no, don't take it personally. That was the lesson for me to learn, is if they say no, it doesn't have anything to do with me. It's not about me at all. It's all about what they want for their table. But I rarely get a no. And I think it's because of the confidence that I come up there with. They feel safe with me or something. And I also don't like tricking them into watching.
Yes, I agree.
I understand that that's a way that a lot of magicians will approach. And I'm not saying that it's wrong. I am only saying I don't like it. I don't like tricking them into watching. Oh, hey, did you lose this thing here? Oh, you didn't lose that thing. How about this thing? Did you lose that thing? And magically turning the thing into a different thing. I can see why it would work. It's just not the approach that I choose.
Personal anecdote number two. I try to limit it to two per episode, is that we were on tour and we were in Arizona and just like hanging out at the hotel restaurant. And some guy walks up to us and goes, I hear you guys are in entertainment. Well, here's a little something for you. And then did a fire wallet and then shut it off and removed his business card. I was like, don't, please go away.
Yeah.
But I can say that. And I was like, please, no. And he's like, what, you don't like a little fun? And I was like, I cannot. With a fire wallet. He's like, you know what this is? Yeah. He's like, oh, okay. You didn't know we were magicians. Okay. Please go away. And then proceeded to try to get into our show. And if he didn't know that we were, I know, if he didn't know that we were magicians and he's still walking up to a table like that, I fear for the people who don't want to be rude. So
right. Yeah.
That it's so frustrating to watch magicians just approach a table and trick you into it, or just go without giving any concern about getting consent from the table.
Right. And I'm big on consent.
Mm-hmm. We should all be.
Yeah, we should all be. Consent for a lot of things.
For everything.
Yes.
As a reminder, please stop giving me hugs. Not you, Suzanne. This is just for people listening. Suzanne, you are allowed to hug me because you give the best
Thank
hugs.
You.
You're welcome. I really, really also like the idea of saying that your server is giving them a gift. Do you see that servers maybe get like treated a little bit better or get a little bit, you know, even a dollar extra in their tips because it feels like they did something for the table?
They absolutely do get treated better. In fact, one of the ways that the servers fight over me is if they have a grumpy table or if they have a table. So often servers will have tables, or the people at the tables, not the tables themselves, but the people at the tables will kind of treat the server as if they're not really people. But after I'm there, they treat them like people. And so they see a shift in their people. And like if somebody has an order that they didn't like, or the order came out wrong or something, and for some reason the people are upset, initially they felt bad about sending me to a grumpy table. But I went, no, 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 honey. It's my job to help the table not be grumpy anymore.
Yeah.
And so if I can turn a table around for the server has more fun, the people have more fun, the server gets a better tip, everybody enjoys their time more, and the people are more likely to come back. By the way, when you're selling your services to a restaurant, don't promise that it will bring people in or bring people back, because that's not something that's quantifiable. So I'm
that's
just going to
really
slip
smart.
That in there, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but I'll slip that in there because that's what was on my head at the time. It does help the server's relationship with the people at the table, with the patrons. It does help their relationship. So me being polite and bringing up the energy and the attitude and the happiness of the table helps all around. And it also helps the vibe of the restaurant. Because if you have a grumpy table, the vibe is grumpy. So it brings more life to the restaurant. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's something that I talk about a lot in terms of sitting in a theater, and the idea that if you want to react, but the person next to you isn't reacting, you feel like you kind of take on, you're very empathetic to that moment and you question your actions. And it's sort of the same with a restaurant, is that if the table next to you is, they're having a great time, you might then go, oh, that table's having a great time, I'm going to also have a great time. And vice versa, it works in negative too.
That is exactly it. That's a great way to describe it.
Boom. So getting a restaurant. What's the best approach to calling up a restaurant and getting it? Because you had mentioned that you don't want to say you can bring in people or keep people. And that's the only approach that I've used or I've heard. So I'm really curious in your argument. And I think your argument is exactly correct. I've just never heard of it. Can you explain more about why not to say that and also what you think is better?
So if you say, oh, I can bring in more people, what happens if the restaurant just happens to be slow because a bunch of people go on vacation because it's spring break or there's something happens with the economy, so people don't go out to eat because the economy gets bad, or I won't even bring up COVID because nobody's going because it's hopefully stupid to be in public right now.
Yeah.
But it's not quantifiable. You can't say, unless they come in specifically to see you and they tell the manager when, or tell the scheduler, the person taking the reservation, the reason we're coming is to see the magician, which they may say that, but they may not, but that may be the reality. There's no way to actually count it. There's no way to prove the uptick in your sales is because of me, because then the downtick in the sales is then also because of you.
Yeah,
so you've got to be careful about that. So I say, the reason to have me is because I can be a liaison to your restaurant. People will tell me things about their experience that they don't tell the server because I am one removed. So when I come up to the table and I get the, yes, we would love to see your magic, the first thing I say is, oh, how is your meal? This is like post-meals. Usually I perform pre-meal, but if I'm performing post-meal, I'll say, how was your meal? They might go, the steak was good, but it wasn't like exactly as I wanted. They'll tell me that. But when the server asks, how was your steak? The person will go, oh yeah, it's great. Because they don't want to be a bother or whatever. Because it's okay, but it's not exactly what they wanted. They will tell me it's not exactly what they wanted. And then I'll tell the server and the server will go, oh, we'll give them a free dessert. Then that is what brings the people back. But it's not because of me. It's because they got good service.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a liaison in that way. I'm also, if somebody drops a fork, I will. And if I'm walking by and I notice that I picked that fork up and I go get them a new fork. Just because I'm a magician doesn't mean I'm not part of the team, right?
Yeah.
So often I find a napkin on the floor. I'll pick up the napkin, go get another napkin. Here, somebody dropped a napkin. This is a clean one. Just because I'm not a server or a busser or the water guy doesn't mean I'm not part of the team. So I will do that as being a liaison to the place. Now, a way to make the management see my value, I mean, the servers see me doing that kind of thing. So that's a value to the servers. But the way that the management sees that I'm a value is I don't only have an approach, I have an exit thing that I say. So let's go with the same restaurant I'm working at, Lord Fletcher's. I bring out my card, I set it down, and I'll say, I'll leave you with one of these. My name again is Suzanne. I'm here pretty much every Saturday night. Unless I'm doing a show somewhere else, and then, of course, I am not here. And sometimes I'll pause long enough so that they can answer it, and if they don't answer it, then I'll say, I'm not here. Then that gets a laugh. And then I'll say, if you enjoyed the magic, please tell your host on the way out. That way I get to keep my job. So that whole thing tells them I'm here pretty much every Saturday night. Also tells them that I accept private shows. So if I'm not here, it's because I'm doing a private show someplace else. They've got my card. And if I tell them, please tell the host on the way out that you enjoyed the magic, they'd go in their heads, oh, that's a great idea. I should tell the host on the way out that we really enjoyed the magic. So then they get all of this feedback on the way out. So if I do 8 tables in a night, 8 tables come up and tell the Even if 5 tables come up and tell the management on the way out, that's a lot of people coming up and saying, gosh, we really enjoyed the magic. And so often I will hear, you know, Suzanne, the only reason we come here is because of you. I mean, the food is okay, but you make the night. I say, could you please tell the management that? And they do. And so if the management or if the host gets that 5 times in a night, they kind of get sick of it, but it's good for me, right? I had one of the hosts even told me one time, she said, God, we just get so many people all the time coming up, how much they love you. And I like that they do that. And it's like, I'm finally saying, yeah, that's why she's here. So the host is telling people, yeah, we know she's great. That's why she's here. So, I mean, they're getting tired of it enough to have a comeback to say, yeah, we know she's great. But if you can have a good approach and a good exit, then I think that just really sells you. And it sells you to the tables for the approach, and it sells you even more to the restaurant. And it makes you invaluable, really, if the people are coming up at the end as they walk out, say, man, we really enjoyed the magician. Mm.
I think that's awesome. I think having something like an exit call to action is really important. I mean, you would do that if you were working a trade show or if you were selling something. So it makes sense that you would also go, here's a call to action for you. If you enjoyed it, tell the appropriate people. It's brilliant.
So right. Exactly. Yeah.
We talked about the beginning. We talked about the end. Let's talk about the middle. How do you, how do you choose material for a restaurant set? I mean, I imagine you produce birds and do like card to prime rib or something along those lines. Yeah. Is that how restaurants work?
Yep. All of those. Yeah. Every single, good. No, actually I don't produce the birds because
damn.
People have asked me, do you have a rabbit? And I said, did you have the chicken? That sort of rolled over you a little bit there, Kayla. Like it took you a second. And then when you got it, you liked it.
I still like it. You're right. As I had to think for a second, like I don't, oh yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm so tickled.
And that's the way it happens with the audience too. They go, yeah.
Slow burn jokes are fantastic.
Okay, so how I pick my material is first, I only had 4 tricks to choose from.
Yes, right. Technically 5, so, though. You just move the plates out of the way and you deal 3 rows of 7. You'd be fine.
And then you hear, oh, I know that one.
Yeah. They grab the deck and do it themselves.
Just poorly.
Oh, of course.
Like, oh yeah, I forgot this part. So how I choose my material. So I have to like the trick first. And card to pocket was one of the first tricks that I ever did. That's one of the first tricks that Al taught me. So I was doing card to pocket from the beginning. And then I met this guy, Seth Kramer, and he was talking about blank ambitious card routines. And I already had an ambitious card routine, and I thought, well, that's really clever, a blank ambitious card routine. So I started playing with that. And I never liked things like, here's a card trick, and then putting the deck away, and then pulling out a little packet trick and saying, and here with these 4 cards, I'll do a thing and then put that away and then take out another packet and do something with 5 cards. Well, why, if you're going to do card magic, why not just take out all the cards that you need from the deck? You know what I mean? So I never liked that idea of putting a deck away and then pulling out another deck and then putting that one away and pulling out another deck. So when I was doing the blank card trick, I thought, oh, you know, I should figure out a way to change those cards into real cards. Because once you do the blank cards, if I was a real magician, I would make them be real cards, right? Mm-hmm. That was a logical progression. So I figured out how to do that. And I invented this little holdout thing that makes it so I can switch the deck really fast. And I started doing that at the restaurant. So I'd open with the blank deck, and then I'd change the cards to real, which was super startling. And then I do the card to pocket. And that was enough time at the table, just with those two pieces, because you don't want to spend more than 10-ish minutes at a table. That's enough. Mm-hmm. So that's my opener. So blank card trick, make the cards real, then card to pocket. And then if they ask me back, then I have some coin magic that I can do, like coins across. I do that. I have extreme burn. That's a good one. But let me go into more why the material that I choose for the restaurant.
Yeah, specifically. And, like, are you doing stuff that's on a table, in their hands?
Yeah, you have very little table space until after dinner, and maybe through dessert, you can have more table space. But you don't want to take up much space in the table. Anything that you can do, if you can take up less space than a plate, that's great. Sometimes you have more room than that, but don't count on more room than that. And the tables are usually like wet or something. Mm-hmm. And I personally do not like a close-up mat. I used to have a close-up mat, and then the more I did restaurant magic, the more I realized how absolutely disgustingly filthy the close-up mat was. And so I just quit using a close-up mat. There's really no need for it. So one of the criteria for material that I choose is, does it have phases that you can stop when somebody comes up? So like if the server comes up to ask a question, you want to be able to stop. And then when they leave, start, go right back where you left off. So you don't want some involved story that they have to be able to like follow this involved story. For instance, I wouldn't do the Band-Aid trick at a restaurant.
Sure.
That's a little too touchy-feely for a restaurant. They want, hey, kind of magic, right? I wouldn't do my cups and balls routine with that story at a restaurant. Well, I wouldn't do that cups and balls routine at a restaurant anyway, because it takes up too much of the table. You want to do something that if the food comes and you're just at the first phase of like an ambitious card routine, you can go, hey, I'm going to leave you now because your food is here. If you'd like to see a little bit more magic after dinner, just let your server know and I'll come back. And then you can come back and finish. Mm-hmm. You can even start over from the beginning and they don't mind. Mm. So you want magic that has phases, like you bring a card to the top. That's magical, just that little part. And then you bring it to the top another way. That's magical. That's a little part. And if the server comes up during the second phase, you can just stop there. You also want to be able to be not 100% surrounded, but you want to be, because you're going to have people to the side. You want to choose something that's not super angly. You want to choose something that it doesn't have to be as amazing as the fire wallet.
Gross. Thank you, Kira. Kira agrees.
Kira agrees. The fire wallet, that is not a good opener. But you do want to have something that has a little bit of a pow effect. And I think that if somebody writes their name on a card and you put it in the middle of the deck and you wave your hand over and snap your finger and the card pops to the top of the deck, it's visual and it has a little bit of a pow factor to it.
Yep.
The reason that I chose the blank card trick to be the intro is because the way I do it, I hand out the blank deck and say, here, shuffle the deck. And so as they're shuffling, that's when they realize that it's blank. And then they're going, the cards are blank. Something that they've never seen before, but they're still cards. So that's interesting. It also shows that I don't take myself too seriously, because my persona is more on the same level as them. I want to be on the same level as them. I don't want to do this one up, be above them, and because it makes me more relatable to be on the same level. And I think when you're doing restaurant magic, being relatable and being on the same level and being playful is more important than being, oh my goodness. Just a second. I'm going to do a little dog training here. Honey, Kira, honey, sweetie, Sweetie, baby, come here. Hi, honey. Come here, sweetie. Come on. Up here. Good girl. We can take all that out, right?
Of course, yeah.
Or we can leave it in, because this is also a good thing, is if one of your people is doing something that you don't want, you don't yell at them and tell them that they're being bad. You redirect them in the direction that you want.
You're right. We're going to get way more into that later.
Right. So we can leave this in. That's good.
For sure.
Yeah. Because she was just doing her job. She was protecting the house.
Yep. Yep.
And that's important, Kira. Right?
She's the best.
Yes.
Yeah, I think material choice is always one of those things that people don't quite know what entails for a restaurant. And I think you've nailed it perfectly.
I do really like magic that happens in the people's hands. So if I can have them do it, like if they wave their hand over the top and give it a snap and the magic happens, that's great. If I can put a card in somebody's hand and it changes, that's great. If I can put coins in somebody's hands and they multiply, that's great. I personally don't like sponge balls at a restaurant because same reason I don't like a close-up mat. But it doesn't mean that a close-up mat and sponge balls are wrong. It's just my preference.
Sure. Yeah. It's also my preference is that if I'm going to do magic in someone else's hand, I don't want them to feel like they need to wash their hands after I'm done for them to eat.
Right. Although and they then should, because if they touch my Sharpie, they have touched every other person who has touched my Sharpie.
Yes, that is a good point.
Yeah, but it has an apparent cleanliness to it.
Yes.
But, you know, have you ever had somebody take the Sharpie and open it with their mouth?
All the time.
That's so gross.
What's wrong? My God. Why? It's not yours.
Would you do that? Right, exactly. Oh, I don't say anything, but it is possible that I would say, oh, I know where that Sharpie has been. But these are full-grown adults. They should know not to put stuff in their mouths, right?
Oh, that's so annoying. Well, it's also the same. A lot of magicians will, as they're doing card magic, will lick their fingers to have more friction.
No, don't do that. Just get some corn huskers lotion or something.
Yeah, you're fine. Don't There's lots of things.
Yeah, lots of things. Don't put stuff in your mouth.
Don't. Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about not putting stuff in your mouth and the cleanliness of stuff. I posted that we were recording today and a lot of people wrote in questions and there were three different questions on this same subject. So Dean Bootcheck wants to know, will restaurant performers have to wait for a vaccine to get back to performing and how will our material need to change when we finally step up to a table of diners again? What if we end up on the other side of a piece of plexiglass like when we have to check out at Walgreens? Graymazing Reed said, what are Suzanne's thoughts about the scary future of restaurant magic? And Allison Clement Lichtman said, not a serious question, but wishful thinking. Can Suzanne please use her magical band-aids to heal us from 2020? So
just did it.
Oh, thank you so much. I feel better. The asteroid's gone. No more alien invasion.
No, we do know that I lie though, right?
What?
We do know that I lie.
When?
I'm sorry. Just no, I don't.
Oh, okay. Oh, I feel better. Feel so much better. What do you think?
Gave poor Kayla panic attack there.
There's already 2020 is a disaster. I can't take anything else.
Yeah.
What do you think is the future of, let's just go with restaurant magic for now, when things start to open back up, specifically for restaurant magic, how will you be changing what you do in order to be able to perform in like a post-COVID kind of world, even though we don't know what that will be?
Well, I initially said, okay, so we'll have our first wave and then people will start washing their hands and then restaurants will open back up again. And then I'll go back for the summer, but then the second wave will hit and I'll have to stop going for a little while. You know, maybe we'll go down to half capacity again. And it just doesn't make sense for the restaurant to have me there if it's half capacity. They can barely pay their servers, let alone pay me.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't blame them for not calling me and saying, hey, are you coming back or not? I am keeping in touch with them, but I don't expect to be going back anytime soon. When we have a vaccine, yes, I think a vaccine is going to help, but with the anti-vaxxers, hey, people, please vaccinate your children.
I'm giving the biggest thumbs up to Suzanne okay. right now. Thank
it's
you.
It's possible that that's the only possibly political thing I'll say. Oh, and wear a mask.
That's not political.
For some odd reason, that is turned political, though. And I don't yeah. understand why protecting yourself and others is a political thing. And vaccinations are the same thing. That's protecting yourself and others. And we'll get into this. I'm a horse owner. And my barn, where I board my horse, requires us to get certain vaccinations for our horses so that we have this really cool thing called herd immunity. And we're hearing about herd immunity in the human population now. There needs to be herd immunity for things like polio and measles and mumps and rubella and smallpox and COVID. So get vaccinated. So once we get our vaccines, then if enough people get vaccinated, which I hope people will, then we'll get enough herd immunity to where it's going to be like, you know, measles or something. So let's not be scared of vaccines. And so that, I think, is going to help Restaurant Magic come back. I was talking to a friend of mine at the horse barn who is in the medical field, and she was saying how she could see why it would be really hard for me to do my job because so much of magic is what we do with our faces. Mm. It's not just what we do with our hands, it's our facial expressions. And if we're missing what's happening with our mouths, that takes away part of our tools, right? So she said, you know, I saw these sign language interpreters who had these face masks that had plastic over the front. So it's like these face masks that you could see your mouths because so many deaf people read lips. So you have to have that. So I ordered some and they're coming in 3 days. So I will have face masks that you can see my mouth. And so I'm going to have those face masks and I'm going to have hand sanitizer on me.
Great.
And anybody who's going to be my helper, I will put hand sanitizer on. Or I might not do that because if I do hand sanitizer every single table, my hands are going to dry out so bad.
Yeah.
That might be a problem. We'll have to see. But I'm going to require anybody who wants to help me uses hand sanitizer. And I will tell them everybody who helps me has used hand sanitizer. That means my Sharpie is clean. My cards are clean. I have on my face mask. You guys can see my face. Then I don't have to worry as much that they don't have on masks because they're dining. They're not going to have on masks. I will say that I'm in a vulnerable category. I won't go into it, but I do have some health issues that if I get sick, it will make me more sick. And this will surprise some people. I'm almost 60. So I am in just in
no.
the age thing. In the age thing, I'm in the vulnerable population. So, and with my underlying health condition, I'm in a vulnerable population. So I don't want to get sick. And I would hate passing on. So that's a long way to answer what is the future of Restaurant Magic. It's kind of a scary proposition. I am hopeful that if people stop being stupid, then we're going to do a lot better. But there's too much of the population right now. They're not taking in consideration how this virus spreads, and they're not being smart. So I don't know if that's a satisfying answer or not.
I think you know more information than a lot of people in terms of you've already put in a lot of thought into it. But of course, we have no idea what it's going to look like. Even between recording this and when this comes out, so much will have changed. So
right.
I love the face mask idea and the hand sanitizer. Yeah, that's about all we can do for right now.
Yeah, I'm thinking about putting hand sanitizer on a pole. So I'll bring the hand sanitizer out and then I'll go like that and it's gone.
Yep, I think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Approved. So check plus on restaurant talk now, because it was a natural progression from what you were just talking about, is you have a horse, two dogs, you train them extensively. And a husband.
That person needs to be trained too.
Oh, great. I also love him so much. So speaking specifically of all of the training you have done, both human and not human, how do you see training animals has changed your magic? And that was my way of asking a question that you asked me to ask you.
Right. And you did it expertly.
Thank you so much.
So I was already a magician when I got my first horse. I got my first horse in 2004. And when I started training him, I realized, and all the reading that I was doing, I realized that horses aren't going to just do what you want because you want them to do it. And then I went, oh, that's kind of like audience helpers don't do what you want just because you want them to do it, huh? And then I saw the parallel, and I saw how it was like real big picture first, but then the more I worked with horses, the more I could see little similarities. One thing about horses is they are prey animals. Do you know what that is, or do you want me to explain what that is?
Maybe explain it, or I can explain it super fast, which is basically they are prey.
Yeah, they are prey. And we humans are predators. We look like predators. Our eyes are on the front of our heads instead of the sides. And all predators, their eyes are on the front of their head. So if you look at a
like
dog,
a lion, a
cat, lion, yeah. Right. The eyes are on the front of the head. That gives them good depth perception. And on the side of the head gives good peripheral vision.
Which, right. To like be looking for the predator. Yeah.
Right. Prey animals need to be able to see more around their heads. When you train a horse, you need to train them out of their right eye first to do something. And then you train them out of their left eye to do something, because their right side and their left side might have different fear levels. But because we look like predators and our ears are pinned, like when a lion is hunting, their ears kind of go back, right?
So we're scary.
We are scary. And if you act like prey around a horse, you will not have the same level of connection with that horse. And then I went, oh my goodness, you know what? Humans have a prey animal side to them and a predator animal side to them. So when you are not the one in charge, when you are the audience participant, you are like a prey animal. And if I approach that person as a predator and try to take over and demand and then make them do something, that puts them more and more and more into the prey animal feel. And not all people go into prey status, but why even approach that? Why even start to get them to that level? So the more I worked with horses, the more I could see the body language. So when she kind of goes, ooh, I don't know if I liked the way you said that to me, she'll do something with her body and I'll recognize it and I'll go, oh yeah, I probably said that a little too harshly. So if you can recognize that body language shift with your audience participants, oh my goodness, it totally changes stuff. Like, I don't do a whole lot of magic for children, but one of the restaurants I work has more children than the other two. So I realized that if I come up to a table just like really hot and ready to go, and I go, hey, I'm the magician, are you ready? And I say that to a little kid, most of the times the little kids are fine, but sometimes I'll see them kind of pull in a little bit. And if they pull in, the worst thing to do is, oh, come on, this is going to be fun. Because that's going to make them pull in even more. You're giving them too much energy. You need to pull the energy back a little. So the first thing I do is take all energy off and turn just my shoulder to the kid. And I talk to the parent. And I will just focus on the parent. And as soon as the parent is seeing and demonstrating to the kid that I'm fine, the kid is fine. And I can glance over to the kid and I will know by the kid's body language when they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes some learning, and the best creature to learn that on is an animal.
Mm.
You know, if you've got a dog, train the dog a trick. I've got my dogs jumping through hula hoops and getting them to sit, stay, and then come one at a time. And now training a predator, a dog is a predator, is different. You get different reactions from them than you do from a prey animal. So if you have an opportunity to train a prey animal like a horse, that's going to skyrocket your communication with your audience participants. Did that answer the question? I felt like I was rambling.
No, it was great. I mean, you offered so much information. Also, I think we say a lot that audience volunteers coming up on stage or being asked to do a task, they are already just inherently nervous because they don't know what's going on. They've just met you. They're now potentially under a lot of light, which then, you know, all of it is pressure. And I love the idea of explaining it as a predator-prey relationship, that you need to not make that, or at least make them know, yes, I might have the ability to be a predator, but I'm not interested in devouring you today. And I think that's really, that's so important that we talk a lot about treating your audience, especially your audience volunteers, with a lot of respect. And it's something we see a lot in magic, that that doesn't happen. And I love putting that description on it. I think it's so, 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 so clear.
Yeah. And also think about your scripting in your instructions of what to do. And think about the pitfalls that you've had before. Like, I've asked somebody to do something and they misunderstood. Figure out where you're not explaining it right. Because if your audience participant makes a mistake, it is not their fault. It is your fault. And I look at that when I ask my horse to do something. If she makes a mistake, it's not her fault. She's just trying to do what I said and she misunderstood. And if she misunderstood, it's because I didn't explain it correctly. So find out the pitfalls, find out the places that, man, they always mess up there. That's a Blaney thing. They always mess up there.
Mm-hmm.
You find out why they always mess up there. It's in the way that you're seeing it.
Absolutely. I can't agree with that more. Unless they decide they purposely want to do something, which is so rare that that is actually something that's going on. I've never had that. And I work mainly for drunk people. I've never had somebody purposefully take a prop and like smash it on the ground or anything. And I think most magicians have maybe one or two stories of that. And so we have to understand that it's not their fault. They're not dumb. They're not trying to mess with you. It is 100% your fault. You're supposed to control the entire situation. And I'm very happy you said that.
Right. And that is going to get me to this one thing that I want to say. And I normally don't pick on performers about certain lines, but this is one line that I really hate. They'll go, "Oh, I'm sorry. I picked you."
Ugh, shut up.
I hate that line. I hate it so much. So bad. Because you are the reason that this person didn't do the thing the way that you wanted them to, and you're blaming them now for it. And then on top of blaming them, you're shaming them in front of everybody else. So if you have that line, please know it's not funny. And if people laugh when you say that, it's because they are uncomfortable.
Yep.
So I'm stepping off my soapbox.
No, I love your soapbox. It's a soapbox that I have gone on many a time on this podcast. So with volunteers, right? So we have that stupid line, but a nice transition is into a question from my friend and yours and ours and everybody's, which is Rob Belchunas.
Rob, I love Rob.
Yes, he specifically says good game, which is an inside joke that no one will understand except you.
I totally get it.
Fantastic. His question was not about that. It was, I would love to hear your thoughts on using volunteers. How do you choose the people you work with? How do you take control of a situation that has lost control? And what feeling do you want to leave your volunteers with? And I feel like a lot of this also stems from what you were just talking about training animals. But how do you choose the volunteers? How do you handle a situation that's gotten a little bit out of hand? And what do you want your volunteers to leave with? Thank you, Rob.
Okay, very good questions. When I'm doing magic at the restaurant, I'll choose the people who are smiling the most. I'll a lot of times choose the person who, if I say, are you ready for some magic? And somebody goes, yeah, that's the person I'm going to choose. And now I have heard some magicians say, oh boy, if they're too enthusiastic, I don't want them. I love the most enthusiastic ones, even if they're going to be, I'm reluctant to say difficult because that's putting a negative spin on it. Let's say challenging. I love the challenging audience participants. I like the enthusiastic person. And here's what you need to remember about the enthusiastic person who wants to interject a lot. They are only trying to take part. They're not trying to mess you up. They're not trying to be mean. They might be trying to take some focus, but they're trying to take some focus because that's a need that they have. And if you can look at it as you are there to meet their needs, this isn't about you. Your performance is not about you. It's about them and their experience and them getting their needs met. Of course, you have to set boundaries. You don't let them walk all over you. But I do like the enthusiastic participant. I like the drunk who wants to grab my hands. I just know the times where I can be open enough so he can grab my hands.
Yes.
And so that's when it's really super important to know your material inside and out, to where you know the dangerous places. And you know when to be guarded and when you don't have to be guarded. That makes you appear to be a more open performer. Because really, if you think about each and every trick you do, there aren't very many places in the trick where you actually have to be guarded. Right?
Right.
Most of the time, people can examine stuff. And so if you get an enthusiastic audience participant who's a little grabby, it's okay as long as you let them grab at the point where it's safe for them to grab. Let them examine your hand when it's safe for you to have your hand examined. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And did I answer all of Rob's questions, or is there more that I didn't get to yet? Oh, how do I handle something when it gets out of control?
Yeah.
I don't have times that it gets out of control anymore. So I'm going to have to think back on when things did get out of control. After realizing that the reason it got out of control was because I didn't notice a warning sign ahead of time. Okay, I've got interesting imagery in my head right now. So let's say you get a fire in a pan on your stove and you don't notice the fire. If you don't notice that pan catching on fire, the fire is going to spread. And if you don't notice that the fire has spread, it's going to catch your kitchen on fire. And if you don't notice that fire has spread, it's going to catch your living room on fire and so on. So the trick is finding out where that fire starts and putting the fire out then before it turns into a tug of war with your audience participant. Because once it's a tug of war, you have lost. I don't care what great put down lines you get, what great, or I guess it's not put down lines, it's like shutdown lines you get. Don't, by the way, don't buy the shutdown line book. Don't do that. You don't need shutdown lines. Just be a nice person. That's all you need. Be a nice person. Unless you're not a nice person, and then maybe do the shutdown lines, and then that's going to make you not be a good restaurant performer. But that's a whole other thing. But put the fire out before the fire gets big, when it's a spark. And that comes with doing. You're not going to recognize the fire until you've had a few of them. But remember them and learn from every fire that you have, learn from it. and remember it and find out what you didn't do to put the fire out sooner. Because once that tug of war starts, you've lost.
Mm-hmm.
So does that answer Rob's question, do you think?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, Rob texted me if it didn't.
Rob saw a show where the guy, that's what the good game is about.
Uh-huh.
Rob saw a show where the guy I had up there was potentially a gigantic fire just walking in the room.
Got it.
And the good game was Rob was at my taping for my Magic Castle teaching DVD, which, by the way, is for sale. You can get it by contacting me at digital download. The guy was really, really super drunk. And Rob came up to me when I came out into the lobby. This was the fourth taping of the show for the DVD. Rob came up to me and went, oh, gosh, you see that guy in that gray suit over there? He is so drunk. And he's slapping people on the butt saying, good game. So apparently that's okay to do nowadays. So that's what the good game is. And so when I told the producer, oh, see that guy over there is really drunk. He said, Suzanne, one of your skill sets is performing for really difficult audience participants. And I think we should have him in. And I went, oh, yeah, that's right. This is a teaching DVD. I'll do one better. I'll have him be my helper.
Mm-hmm.
And so he ended up being the helper for my show. So Rob saw me handle that guy who could have been a train wreck for another performer who didn't have the background that I have of doing 30 years in a restaurant with very drunk people and knowing how to not have a tug of war.
Yeah.
So if you want to see how to handle a difficult audience participant, get that digital download. And if you mention Shazam, normally I sell that digital download for $40. I will sell it to you for $30.
Wow.
Through PayPal at suzanne@suzmagic.com and then $30 instead of $40. Just say Shazam.
There you Amazing. Go. Thanks. And that's awesome. What a fun day. So from watching you perform, I think you can deal with these difficult people in part because of your personality on stage. And many other magicians can't because they have a different personality or no personality or someone else's personality that they've borrowed for this show. How did you develop your personality? And then how did you choose costumes and props to match your persona that you cultivated for on stage?
Okay, so let's do first, how did I choose my costume? I think that I just wanted to wear something comfortable. And I am sort of an androgynous-y sort of person anyway, so I wasn't going to wear a dress. I don't feel comfortable in dresses. So I was going to wear slacks. My first costume was a little tux coat with tails and a bow tie, and I thought that was really cute. But then later, I had this Japanese schoolboy's uniform, and I got that from Luna Shimada, and she wasn't wearing it anymore, and she asked me if I wanted it, and I went, yeah, that would be a great magic coat, because it had a lot of really cool pockets and stuff in it. So it was really more just finding things that I felt comfortable wearing. So it wasn't necessarily a conscious choice other than I wanted to be comfortable. I mean, my regular clothing is jeans and t-shirts anyway. So find something comfortable. When I was first trying to figure out what I wanted to wear, of course, the guys said I needed to wear a dress and be pretty and wear makeup and do my hair a certain way. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't. Because I don't think it's as important as other people think it is. If you're not comfortable wearing what you're wearing, that's going to show. So
yeah, it's way more obvious.
Okay, so that's what I wear. So did you ask how did I choose my character?
Yeah, how did you make your personality strong on stage? How did you make it obvious? You talked about your costume, but also your props. How did you understand to match those things to the personality?
So the props are going to match to the personality as long as you have a good sense of what your personality is, because how you handle a deck of cards is going to be part of your personality, you know? Mm-hmm. It's all going to flow together, but you have to understand who you are. So I wasn't purposeful in, like, I didn't pick a character. I'm going to use my good friend Pop Hayden as an example. When I met Pop, he was Whit Hayden, and he had this professorial kind of character to him that he developed over the years. And it actually was really a bigger version of himself. But then when he made the decision to switch over to Pop, I saw the evolution of him turning into Pop, and that was a conscious choice. And he chose that because he was getting older and he didn't think that his character was going to age with him. So he wanted to find a character that he could grow into. And I may have to do that eventually, but I found an aspect of myself that was playful and outgoing that I could just accentuate. So big surprise, Kayla, I am really, really, really introverted introvert. Did you know I was an introvert?
I did. And I think that's why we became friends, because it didn't cost me energy to be friends with you.
Oh, cool. I like friends that it doesn't cost me energy to be friends with them. But if I was going to perform magic, I was going to need to learn how to be an extrovert. So I just thought of extroverted things like laughing and saying hi and talking to people and things like that. And magic helped me be more extroverted. So I was actually even using magic as a tool to connect with people. So it was kind of a vehicle that I could connect with people through magic. But it was more just finding an extroverted aspect of me and accentuating it, making it bigger. And that ended up being a character for me. It wasn't as conscious as I'm making it sound. So it evolved into me. And then there was also these little aha moments that it's like, oh, wow, magic allowed me to kind of peel off this part of me that I wasn't and expose a part that I was.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound a little too existential? Or?
Yeah, but just kidding.
You get what I'm trying to say, right?
I do, yes.
Like I had this view of myself, but once I started doing magic, I was able to go, oh yeah, that's not even who I am anymore. I'm more like the magician part.
Mm-hmm.
So you've known me long enough, Kayla. Do I, when I'm not performing, am I just a more laid back version of my performing self?
Yes.
Yeah.
Your classification of it, I actually think is the correct one, which is your performance self is the extroverted version of your real self.
Okay. And a more exaggerated version, because you have to Yes. exaggerate it on stage.
Of
But
course.
I didn't choose a character.
Mm.
Like I would say Pop Hayden is a character. I would say Rob Zabrecki's character is a character.
Yes, for sure.
But I wouldn't say that my performing self is actually a character. It's just a bigger version of the extroverted me.
Yeah.
Our Books to Read segment this week is brought to you by a bunch of books. It's the Eli Marks Mystery Series. Yay! The book I want to talk to you about this week is called Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot by Mickey Kendall. In my opinion, with only having read a little less than half of this book, it's top three most important books of 2020, and it's only third after White Rage and How to Be an Anti-Racist. I think this book is incredibly informative. A lot of people, including myself, don't understand that feminism is often really white feminism. It's often a movement and a goal of progress that has left out women who aren't white. And obviously that's terrible. I'm certainly a part of this, have benefited from the white feminist movement, and haven't understood how I have profited for myself off of it without understanding how I'm playing more into white feminism and not just feminism. So it's really important for me to educate myself on this, but it's important that we all educate ourselves on white feminism versus feminism, because it's how we help everybody and lift each other up and have a better world. Yay, better world. Let's do it together. And this is one of those books. So like I said, I'm not completely done with it. I'm not even halfway yet, but it's really good. It is a really hard read. I get really angry. Hopefully you will also get angry, because I think it means you care. And that's important. And this book is also beyond important. So please do yourself and the world a favor and get Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot by Mickey Kendall. Link is obviously in the show notes. This segment was sponsored by the Eli Merks Mystery Series. Teller, you got it, of Penn and Teller, had to say this. I liked the accurate behind-the-scenes aspect of it. Usually magic detective stories don't really have a clue about the mentality and preoccupations of magicians. Yours is true to life. You can pick up the first book in the Eli Marks Mystery Series, The Ambitious Card, for just 99 cents. Go grab your copy at elimarksmysteries.com. That's elimarksmysteries.com. Link in the show notes. And like I have said before, this is a really fun read. It is a very enjoyable world to be a part of. So definitely go check it out. You're going to like the story. There's magic. There's murder. There's mystery. Oh my goodness, it's the perfect combination. So definitely go get it. I was not asked to say that. I was not asked to read it, but I am, and I'm enjoying it. Go get both books. Now. The end.
Hi friends, Richard Young here from the Magicians Podcast. I'm just stopping by to let you know about a brand new amazing project I've been working on, which I'm finally able to share with you. It's not a podcast. It's actually an amazing magic gimmick that creates the most incredible visual change of a playing card ever conceived. And there are dozens of applications for this new gimmick, as the face of the card can change up to, believe it or not, 4 times. We have face changes, back colour changes, cards that go blank in midair, and loads of others too. We can even make customised cards that you dream up, as the possibilities are endless. There are some fascinating untapped uses for mentalism too. Visit the website right now to see the trailer, changingcards.com. That's changingcards.com.
The Historical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. This week's historical woman is Lady Frances. So Lady Frances was well known at the same time as Del O'Dell, but is significantly less known today. She got her start in magic by assisting her husband, Larry Hess, not Larry Haas, like Dr. Larry Haas, Larry Hess. I did, while reading this, think that Larry Haas was maybe a Time Lord traveling through space and time, and I believe I'm incorrect after seeing side-by-side photos. So Larry Hess was Lady Frances's husband, and she was assisting him in 1934. There is some evidence that says she might have assisted Harry Blackstone Sr. as well. And after assisting these magicians, she developed her own show and started touring in 1946. She headlined at a lot of hotels and clubs and made many TV appearances. In 1946, she was awarded the Best Act Involving the Use of Magical Apparatus Either in Whole or Part at the PCAM convention. What is that award? That is a very long titled, like, how do you fit that on the trophy? But the PCAM convention is a fantastic convention and magic organization. So that's really cool. Lady Frances was on the cover of Genie in 1951. We'll post a picture of that on the Shazam Instagram. She retired for a bit. She hosted a cooking show on television, which was very random, but she knew a lot about TV and TV production, so she ended up hosting her own cooking show. She then toured some more. She got married again to a different person and then retired again. She had a whole kind of retired, come out of retirement time, and then she came back to compete at the SAM convention in 1980, where she won the Best Female Magician that year. I'm very happy that award is gone, but it's really cool that she won it. Lady Frances belonged to the New York Magicians Guild, Los Angeles Magic Gals, Chicago Roundtable, IBM, the Magicians Alliance of Eastern States, and PCAM. Lady Frances wrote a column in The Linking Ring about doing magic on television. Outside of magic, she was in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps during World War II, where she rose through the ranks and became a captain. At that time, she was praised for having a very visual act and having an amazing multiplying candles routine, which she often closed with. She would also sing during her act and during the candles routine, which gained her a lot of notoriety. There's some information that Frances and Jerry Larson were really good friends and often traveled to magic conventions and gatherings together. I'm super sad to have never seen the two together because they were so influential and revolutionary, especially for being women in this industry. But I can just picture the two of them going around, hanging out at these magic conventions, kicking bum. And that is Lady Frances. This segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Every week, if you listen to the Penguin Magic Podcast, you get a 25% discount code on the featured download of the week. You can hear stories from your favorite magicians behind the scenes at Penguin and save money on some of the best new magic. Visit podcast.penguinmagic.com.
We've referenced you before on the podcast about costume and prop choice and how you've chosen things that fit you so well. And I want to talk specifically about both the Band-Aids and the cups and balls. So your routine, we'll link to it in the show notes, the cups and balls, which I believe is from the castle.
Yep.
So both Conrad Colin and Taylor Hughes want to know about the evolution of the cups and balls routine. So how did you decide on the story? How did it come about? And how did it evolve into what is now part of the show? Correct me if I'm wrong. Part of the show that won you Close-Up Magician of the Year at the Castle, yeah?
You are not wrong.
Cool.
And that's on the Magic Castle digital download that...
Which you're selling, right?
Which I'm selling.
For $30 for Shazam gift?
Yeah, yes. Right, as long as they say the name of this lovely podcast.
There you go.
I'm also selling in a kind of a workshop form or a one-on-one form the routine, the cups and balls routine.
Ah, great. Cool. And so if someone wants to learn that, where they can go to your website and contact you?
They just contact me through my email.
Brilliant.
And that's normally going for $500, but when I'm doing a lecture or a thing like this, I cut it in half.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is an amazing day.
Yeah, so it's $250 and you get the routine and 3 hours of instruction and videos that you get to, because I teach the routine in video form first and you get them in the phases. So this is how you do this phase and this is how you do this particular sleight in this phase. And then you get instruction that goes along with it so I can help you because some of it is a little on the complicated side, sleight of hand wise, but... Okay, so the evolution of the cups and balls. The first time I did the Magic Castle was in 1988, and Al Schneider taught me his cups and balls routine, which the physical part of the routine is Al Schneider's. So I did it with his scripting, and his script was something like, this is the oldest trick in the history of magic. It's called the cups and balls. I have three cups and I have three balls, and this is the way they did it in England, and this is the way they did it in France, and this is the way they did it in Germany. And so each phase had a different country associated with it. So that's how I did it the first time I worked the Magic Castle in 88. And then in 1998, I went to mystery school in upstate New York because Eugene Berger was part of mystery school. And Eugene Berger at that point was a mentor of mine. So everything from then on needed to have some meaning to it, which now I've kind of evolved a little bit that not absolutely everything I do needs to have meaning, but I do like some magic that does have meaning. So I can have both. But when I was coming back to the Magic Castle in 1998, I wanted to have the entire show needed to have meaning. And I had a couple other pieces that I no longer do, and then the Band-Aid trick and the cups and balls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, oh, I could just do the cups and balls to music. That would be really pretty, wouldn't it? To just do it with music. But I was, this is going to sound real woo-woo, and I'm not a woo-woo person, but I was studying this kind of meditation called the Jose Silva method. And I don't buy into his whole thing. If anybody studies Jose Silva, he's saying, when you get into this meditative state, there are these astral beings that if you ask a question prior to the meditation, then they will answer your question. I don't buy into the astral being. I think it's actually kind of your subconscious is answering the question for you. But I was also studying, at the same time of studying this meditation, I was also studying lucid dreaming. So I found out that if you ask yourself before you go to sleep, remember your dreams. I guess that's a command, isn't it? Remember your dreams before you go to sleep. You'll remember your dreams better. And especially if when you wake up, you write them down, it kind of trains you to remember your dreams. And then you can have a little bit of lucidity with them. So I was in the process of all of that in this outside of magic study that I was doing. And I wanted to find a new script for Cups and Balls. And so I said, dream a new script. And I'm like, remember the dream, dream a new script. And I woke up at 4 in the morning with the Cups and Balls routine running through my head and a script very similar to the one that I have now. But it was talking about three sisters that had different personalities and different ideas of how to do things. And each phase, because also I knew this routine inside and out, upside, backwards, because I had done it so many times from 1988 to 1998, I had done it so many times, and I knew it in my soul. So my dream could do the routine, and my subconscious could pick up the script. And so I had this whole thing, but it was about sisters. When I worked with it a little bit, I realized that it didn't work as well with sisters as it would be with some travelers or people on a journey or something, because then it's more relatable if it doesn't have a gender to it, because the three travelers could be anybody, right? I also didn't want it to sound religious. I used to say different theologies instead of different philosophies. Because philosophy is different than religion. So I changed that word, theology, to philosophy. So they all had a different philosophy. Because a philosophy could be a philosophy of life. It could be a philosophy of raising children. It could be a philosophy of how to do magic or how to train a horse or how to do whatever, right? So that made it more relatable and less likely to be viewed as a religious thing, because I'm not a religious person. So it just sort of evolved. When I first started doing it, I wasn't very good at having it roll off my tongue. I was in my head too much, and I sounded a lot like Captain Kirk.
Great.
So when I look at old videos of me, because I would video all my performances, when I look at old videos of me, it's like, oh man, I'm William Shatner so bad right there. And I also needed to make it sound more conversational instead of preachy, because I think it sounded quite preachy in the beginning. And then every time I do it, I think about what that particular phase means, what that particular part of the script means, and I try to put that in my heart. And that sounds sort of weird, but I try to put the message of that particular phase in my heart when I'm telling it. As a storyteller, I think that's important.
Kira agrees.
Kira does agree.
Great. Well, we will definitely link to the Cups and Balls so that everybody can watch it, which I think is so good, obviously.
Thank you. And that version, by the way, that's on my website, that particular version was taped in 2009. I'm going to say it's better now. And the version that's on the digital download is better.
Got it.
So the Band-Aid trick.
Yeah.
I love that piece so much. I saw this guy, his name is Joe Given. He's a magician in Colorado. He's got this really beautiful theater. I haven't seen it, but I have seen pictures of it. I think it's called Theater of Dreams or something like that.
Yeah.
So go to his website. I think it's just called Theater of Dreams and look at the website. They have lots of performers there. They're probably not having performers there now, but I'd like to work there someday. He developed this cool trick called the Band-Aid Transpo. And in 1998, just come from the mystery school, the main IBM convention, you know, the big one, was in Minneapolis. And Eugene was going to be there, and some other people from mystery school were going to be there. And being in Minneapolis, well, geez, I needed to go. So I got a registration and went, and Joe Given was there. That's the first time I ever met Joe. Because I was the girl in the audience, Joe called me up on stage and he did the Band-Aid trick on me, Band-Aid Transpo. Now, his presentation, I didn't resonate with very well. I'm not saying it's a bad presentation. I'm just saying I didn't myself resonate with it. It seemed too big for what the prop was. But I did like the transposition, and it seemed like a puzzle to me, so I wanted to know how the puzzle works, so I bought the lecture notes of the piece. And when I found out how it worked, I went, yeah, I'll never do that. It's futzy, and yeah. And I couldn't think of a presentation. So that was early summer of 98, and I was booked to work the castle in the fall of 98, and I needed to come up with some stuff. Well, I had that Band-Aid trick and the how-to in the back of my head, and my son, who was 8 at the time, was running around the house, and he banged his elbow on the door frame, and hitting your elbow hurts. And so he screamed and ran to me, Mom, I have to have a Band-Aid. And I looked at his elbow and I went, oh, sweetie, you're not even bleeding. And he was crying and he said, no, Mom, I have to have a Band-Aid. So that trick that was in the back of my head went, that's what the trick's about. And I thought, oh, gee, should I write down the script for this or should I be a mom first and put out the Band-Aid on? And I chose to put the Band-Aid on because I could remember the trick. So I put the Band-Aid on, his tears dried up, and he started bombing around the house again. And then I realized the perfect thing for that Band-Aid trick was really, what do kids think about what Band-Aids are? And kids think they're magic. Mm. So that's how I came up with a script for that. So it really sort of wrote itself once my son injured his elbow.
That's great. And it fooled Penn and Teller.
And it fooled Penn and Teller, but I had to change it to fool Penn and Teller.
Sure, so, makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so the version that you see on my website, if you were to watch that version and you were to watch the Penn and Teller version, you'll see that it's different.
Mm.
So the original version, Penn and Teller would not have been fooled by.
Sure.
Because one of their guesses, because if you're careful and listen to what Penn said, they guessed two things.
Mm.
They guessed you dumped garbage on the table. But how he said that, instead of saying you dumped garbage on the table, he said, we can assume everything on the table is examinable. So that was a clever way to get out of doing a guess, because if I went, oh, you guys got me, then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he guessed that it was a slate trick.
Mm.
So I can't tell you how I did it because I do not have Joe Given's permission to teach the Band-Aid trick. And I'm going to respect him on that. I will say, however, if you purchase Joe Given's version of the Band-Aid trick, and you can prove to me that you purchased it, you can give me $20 and I will tell you how I changed it.
It's great.
But I had from January when I was asked if I wanted to be on the show, because I was on the first season. I don't know, when the season that you were on, did you need to audition?
I mean, I had to send in a tape.
Okay. Because I, well, maybe I did have to send in a tape. But I was asked to be on the show.
Mm-hmm.
So the first season, Johnny Thompson and Mike Close got to write a list of the people that they wanted to see.
Yes. So I was actually also on that list.
Oh.
But I didn't have anything.
Oh.
Because okay. I had just met Johnny and he recommended me because I was a young woman trying to make her way in magic or at least be a professional. And I was like, I literally called them and said, I love you so much. I'm so bad. I have nothing for you. And he was like, okay, yeah, sounds great. So yes, I understand that. But yeah, I think most people have to like send in a video and whatever.
Okay. So I had from January when I was asked to April when it was taped to fix the trick, because I sent Johnny the one that's on the YouTube channel. And he said, yeah, I think I know what's going on, but, and he guessed half of it. And he said, well, I think you're doing this here. And I said, yeah, I am doing that there. And he said, well, stop that. And I went, but that's how that works. And he said, you're smart enough, you can figure it out. And that's about the amount of encouragement that I got from Johnny. But it was good enough because it got me thinking and thinking about how I could get past the problem of throwing something away.
Mm-hmm.
Because that ends up being a problem. And so when you compare the two, when you look at, sadly, they edited out for time certain things that could have been on screen that would have made people go, man, I really don't get it. They took certain things out that were proving that my hands were empty, that if they hadn't taken that out, it would have eliminated some of the guesses that people on my YouTube channel made.
Does
that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But they edited those things out because they needed to shorten the routine. But yeah, I really love that piece. And I still do it the way that I did it for Penn and Teller now, because it's, my opinion, a superior way to do it. It's more deceptive and it's only a little bit more futzy than the original.
And that's the point. I mean, we take what other people create and make it better and make it for ourselves. So,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. So I don't know if you know this, but at the end of every episode, we do the same thing, which is the lightning round. So I have a couple So I have a couple of different questions or kind of a list. And two of the questions are going to be from someone who wrote in with a question for you. And the others are just fun ones I wrote down during our time together. Your choice.
Okay.
You can either answer these super fast, like lightning, or super long and drawn out like Max Maven. So choose what you'd like.
I'll be like Max Maven when I grow up.
I mean, don't we all? I keep that joke in too, because most guests haven't heard it, but everyone at home is going, oh, come on, Kayla, we get it. But I'm keeping it in as long as everyone laughs. Anyway, here we go. Lightning round.
Lightning round.
And go. What's your go-to magic book, video, or resource?
Magic book, video, or resource. Al Schneider's YouTube channel.
Oh, great. Perfect. What's been your favorite activity to do during a pandemic?
Go to the horse barn.
Boom. BB.
That's my favorite activity, period.
Make sure to send me a photo of BB as well, and we'll post it.
Oh,
because she's perfect. So if you met a woman who is interested in doing magic at any level, what would be your biggest recommendation for her costume choice?
Be yourself.
Perfect. Dan Manson wants to ask, what is one dream you'd still like to fulfill?
Scuba diving.
Oh, me too. Yep.
Okay.
Great.
Living in Minnesota, scuba diving is boring. So I live in a bad place to want to scuba dive.
Do you know what? One day, Suzanne, let's do it together. We'll get certified and then we'll be diving buddies.
Let's do it.
Okay, done.
Okay.
What's your biggest pet peeve about magicians?
That they, and not all of them, I'm just saying the pet peeve, they think that they are more important than they are, and they think the magic is about them when it's actually about the experience that the audience participant has.
Thank you very much. Who is a woman in magic or some entertainment that we should all check out?
I don't know how much she's performing anymore, but Luna Shimada has such amazing stage presence. Mm-hmm. And she and I used to hang out a lot, and I miss her. So if she listens to this podcast, Luna, I miss you, honey. She has an amazing stage presence, and I learned a lot from her about that. So if you want to learn how to be on stage and own the entire stage and not just where your feet are, she is the one to look at. In fact, if you have an opportunity to take lessons from her about stage presence.
That's amazing.
Yeah, her.
If you could eat one dessert for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, wow. Dessert has kind of gone crappy for me because I had to go gluten-free. If I could only eat one dessert.
I mean, you can add like any dessert that you could not eat now, but in theory.
Got it. And I can eat this. Mango and sticky rice.
It's so good.
I would eat that every dang day.
Yep. This is great. Amazing. We did it. Oh,
yay. Man.
Thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Oh, are you hugging me? I'll hug you too. Oh, stop licking me. Not I'm you, Kira, Kira weren't too. Licking me. My dog was licking me.
Was Maggie not licking you? I meant Maggie. You.
Maggie.
Oh, Maggie. Oh, Maggie.
Now Kira's also licking me. I'll also send you pictures of my dogs.
Oh, of course. We'll post them as well. Thank you very much, Suzanne. Amazing.
Thank you. It was great to see you, honey.
You as well.
Bye.
And that's the episode. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at SheZamPod. For all things swag, head over to our website at shezampod.com for shirts, pins, and that coveted Don't Touch Me skateboard. You know you need it. If you are interested in the bonus content for this episode and future episodes, plus exclusive swag designs, behind-the-scenes content, and shout-outs in episodes, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/shezampod. Links to everything are in our show notes. You can also sponsor one of our many segments this season. I still have some spots left, so please email me at shezampod@gmail.com if you'd like to find out more. Shazam is sponsored in part by the International Brotherhood of Magicians and the Society of American Magicians. Thank you to the IBM and the SAM for your support. Our audio producer is Chris Combs. The Shazam theme song is recorded and produced by Kevin Karikas with vocals by Jonah Fagel. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.